7AP5CR, State versus Dosi J. Nadina, arguing on behalf of the defendant is Richard L. Kaiser. We will then hear from Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien, and then Mr. Kaiser, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Kaiser.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Richard Kaiser. I represent the appellant Dosi Nadina, who is here today in hopes of vindicating his right to a speedy trial, a right which has been described by our own, I'm sorry, right to a public trial. I wouldn't have caught that except I saw the Chief Justice frown when I said speedy trial. This right has been described by our own Court of Appeals in State versus Vaness as a fundamental right, a basic tenet of our judicial system, the most effectual safeguard of testimony, and indeed the soul of justice. The United States Supreme Court has been no less strong in its description of the importance of this right. It has said that the denial of a public trial right is so intrinsically harmful that it requires automatic reversal, and that the denial necessarily renders a trial fundamentally unfair. Now, this case is chiefly about how easily a defendant will have been held to
have waived. How easily what? I didn't hear that. How easily
a defendant will have been held to have waived or given up or forfeited his right to a public trial. If the Court of Appeals decision is permitted to stand here, it will in effect foreclose any meaningful review of the loss of a public trial right for somebody in Mr. Nadina's position who, through no fault of his own, based on no decision he made, based on no strategic decision made by defense counsel, but simply because his counsel did not realize he had the right to object or a right to a speedy trial, failed to do so.
Well, why not put it then under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, certainly that's the state's position. We would argue that the right is so important here that we never need to get to that point, based on other case law in this state and case law from other states. Primarily, I'm talking about two decisions, which are pretty close. One is from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Walton versus Briley, that says you never get to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. That argument there was made by the state as well and specifically rejected in a case involving the closure of a trial. There, the courthouse doors had been closed inadvertently because of late night sessions, and it kept the defendant's fiancée from attending two of those sessions. No objection was made by the defense at the time that the error was, or the closure was discovered, and so the state argued in the state court proceedings that the issue was waived and the only way to get review was through an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Walton versus Briley, in a very well-reasoned decision, said not so quick. We have a right here that is very much like these other rights which are meant to ensure fair trials, like the right to assistance of counsel, like the right to a trial by jury. And it equated those rights with the right of a public trial and said we're not going to find a waiver of such a precious right merely by a silent record. In fact, it said that every presumption will be indulged against the waiver of a right in that situation. And it held that...
What would you have had the trial court judge do?
In this case?
Yes. Here.
At the time that she started to express concern that maybe the sequestration order was in jeopardy, which she had issued a couple days earlier, Waller, given the breadth of the closure order that followed, All family members, but the mother had to leave. Given the breadth of that order, the proper route would have been to conduct a hearing to determine whether there was any basis whatsoever for her concern. Because at that point, Your Honor, all she had was the fact that she had seen family members come into the courtroom and leave the courtroom at times, which happens in every trial. She had seen people talking in the courtroom. But remember, these were not witnesses. These are not people who were under the sequestration order. And there was no indication as of the point that the closure order was issued that anyone had violated the sequestration order. So at that point, Waller would say, if you're going to take this drastic remedy, You have a hearing. You conduct a hearing, and you determine whether or not this concern on your part is merely speculative or whether there's some basis for it. And if it was indeed established that people were violating this sequestration order, then the people who were doing so could have been not only ejected, but people who had been infected by that, witnesses, could have been precluded from testifying. But remember, this judge didn't just exclude people she saw talking in the courtroom. She took the further leap and said anybody in the family, whether they had been here before or not, or whether they were related to witnesses or not, had to leave. And my tally brings the number of people who would have been excluded anywhere from 8 to as many as 12 or 13 family members.
Counsel, you say Waller would have required such a hearing.
Yes, sir.
However, are there not two fairly large distinctions between the Waller case and the case at issue here? In other words, in Waller, the closing of the courtroom was done over the objection of the trial counsel. True?
That's correct.
And I believe, is it also true to say that in Waller, the entire courtroom was closed, whereas here it was closed to certain family members?
Those would be two distinctions. In addition, though, Your Honor, there are numerous cases since Waller, applying Waller, both in this state and elsewhere, that have not simply restricted closures or not restricted the finding of a public trial violation, simply where an entire courtroom was closed, or in, for that matter, to cases where there has been an objection. There are numerous cases, including a case from this court, the case entitled Manitowoc County, where it was only a partial closure during the testimony of a single witness at a preliminary hearing, which this court found was a violation of a public trial right sufficient to raise Sixth Amendment concerns.
Counsel,
yes.
Sorry.
The entire courtroom or just a few in the preliminary hearing in the Manitowoc County case?
The entire courtroom was not cleared. In fact, the statute under scrutiny there permitted the trial court, in fact, I think mandated the trial court to say family members can stay. Family members of either the victim who's testifying or family members of the defendant can stay. In addition, Judge Hazelwood in that case had ruled that the press would be able to view the proceedings. And the Supreme Court specifically said that the presence of the press was no substitute for the right of the public under the Wisconsin statute and Constitution to be present during those proceedings.
So it was a public exclusion.
It was members of, well, actually the statute wanted to exclude everybody who weren't family members or who didn't have, who weren't there to support either the defendant or the witness or the press.
Which would generally be the general public.
People wandering in and out, yes, sir.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm going to use a hypothetical. And I'm going to, as I see these students out here and see how well-behaved they are and how well-dressed they are, nevertheless, use them in my hypothetical. And I'm going to say, let's say the students over here, as we are presiding, let's say I'm a circuit court judge again, and the same kind of courtroom here, and the students are, as witnesses, are testifying, some of them are chatting, some of them are going in and out. I'm sitting up there trying to conduct a trial with, and I hear them discussing matters as witnesses are on the stand, oftentimes in a very animated and elevated fashion. In other words, it's bugging me. It's probably annoying or at least taking the attention of the jury as to what's going on in the witness stand. So I say, okay, I sent the deputy to ask them to be quiet, and they're still going in and out, and chatting. I say to myself in my mind, okay, I've had it, and I say, I'm now going to require all the students to leave. And the students over here, of course, were just as good can be, but you know, I want all of the students out. Now everyone else remains. Is that a violation of the right to a public trial?
I'm going to sound like a candidate here. It's going to depend, okay? First of all, we would agree that every court has a right to control its courtroom from disruptions. Defense attorneys likewise don't like disruptions, don't like the jury being diverted from the witness's testimony. Here, though, we have a different situation, Your Honor. Judge Kumanich had issued a single admonition the day before, prior to closure, and it had been effective. By her own statements from the bench at the end of that day's proceedings, indicated I issued I had my bailiff talk to the people who were talking. Since then, there's been no further violations of my order. So the directive to that group who were there that day was sufficient. There was no telling the next day whether the people who were then talking in the courtroom were the same people or different people, and whether an admonition wouldn't have been sufficient.
Well, let's say the warning the students the second time may have been sufficient, or asking a couple of more teachers to be here may have been sufficient. But I didn't choose that way. I just said, sorry, students, I like it that you're here, but not under these conditions. All students out. Does that implicate the defendant's right to a public trial?
Well, you know, again, it would depend. Let's say those students are the only people in the courtroom.
No. That's not what we've got here.
Well,
if they were, I think it's a closer case. But we're talking about other people in the courtroom, mm-hmm. as is evidenced by all of these faces looking at me.
Right. Again, I would want to know how long that exclusion order was in effect. Was it in effect for the remainder of the day?
No, I don't want them in.
Okay. I think it could very well implicate a right to a speedy trial, because especially the...
Speedy trial.
I'm sorry.
Public trial.
I've been drinking coffee this morning, and the word speedy is in my head. I lost my train of thought.
It might very well implicate the right to
right
a public
speedy
trial.
A public trial. Because the statute in Wisconsin, which, of course, the court referred to in Manitowoc County when it talked about the Sixth Amendment right as well, was concerned about the language that said every member of the public has a right to be present. But I'm not drawing my line in the sand there, because we've got another factor in our case which distinguishes clearly your hypothetical, and that's that it was family members. And there is language in our brief from many cases, which dates back to a Supreme Court case, N. Ray Oliver, that said, at a minimum, the Sixth Amendment right is held that the defendant has a right to the attendance of family members and friends and counsel. And it has, and that has made a significant impact in the case law that's developed since N. Ray Oliver, whereas the Seventh Circuit in, I forget the name of the case now, relied on by Brown versus Powell, said that, look, the only exclusion here was a member of the jury panel who was struck wanted to watch the trial. I said, no problem. And the Seventh Circuit pointed out, of course, this wasn't an instance where we were excluding a family member. So that's a very important distinction. Courts have, in fact, N. Ray Oliver again talks about the importance of having interested spectators. Interested spectators view the trial, support the defendant, and later talks about interested spectators really being family members. And that's what we had here.
Mr. Kaiser, you're talking about the Oliver case.
Yes, sir.
The state called our attention within the last couple of days to the Rodriguez case, which is a case that comes out of the Second Circuit in 2008. And it's my understanding that Rodriguez basically says, look, the reference to family members in Oliver is nothing but dicta. It's not something that we have to be concerned about. How do you respond to that?
There are not only Rodriguez, I think there's one other case that takes a similar position, and there's an important distinction to be made there. Those are habeas corpus proceedings, and a very narrow issue is being looked at, and that was whether the action taken in the state court clearly violated some precedent from the United States Supreme Court. And so those two courts, one court that you referred to and another one, looked at the language in Oliver very closely and said that language was not necessary for the ruling in that case. We're not going to call it precedent. And therefore, the fact that it was a family member that was excluded here is one factor to consider. It doesn't control. That is the limitation of that language that the state cites to, Your Honor. It doesn't mean that the relationship of those people excluded to the defendant is never a factor. In fact, there are cases since a couple of those cases that have again talked about the importance of family members being present, still citing the N. Ray Oliver language.
Well, now, in this particular case, if I understand the facts correctly, we've got the judge saying, okay, the family members have been talking back and forth. I'm really concerned about my sequestration order. I'm concerned about maintaining order in the courtroom because of all of the interruptions going on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to remove the family members, but not totally. I'm going to leave the mother of the defendant in the courtroom. And in addition, my order doesn't apply to the instructions conference, doesn't apply to the closing arguments. They could all be back for that. My concern, I'm speaking for the judge now, her concern was pure and simply that she wanted to maintain the sequestration order and order in the courtroom. So she didn't really say all family members out forever. She said everybody but the mother goes out now, but you can all come back for closing arguments and instructions. Doesn't that make a difference?
It does not, Your Honor, because the way I read the law, courts have, when they talk about the importance of the public trial right and what attributes the right brings to a trial, it is typically more related to what happens during the testimonial portion of that trial. Those things that the courts have talked about that the right brings to the trial are things like preventing perjury. That's one of the top on the list, preventing perjury, having interested spectators in the courtroom that will keep the witnesses honest. In this case, we had an uncle of the defendant who pointed to the defendant as saying, he's the one who stabbed my son. Of course, there's other evidence that he had asked himself, somebody else, earlier in the evening, who had done it, as though he hadn't seen it. But at trial, he said, it was my nephew who did it. Who better than family members to keep him honest? Who better than family members to make that witness look into their eyes and recount what he says happened? That's one thing that was totally missing when the family was made to leave. The presence of the mother was not able to fulfill any of the purposes of the right to a public trial. She couldn't speak English. So many of the witnesses who testified after the family was ordered to leave spoke in English. She would not have had a clue what was occurring in the courtroom.
Now, wasn't there an interpreter there interpreting from Albanian to English?
The only interpreter there was seated at the defense table to interpret English into Albanian. The only other interpreter ever used was when there was an Albanian witness speaking, so she could field the questions and interpret it in English. People in the courtroom, if they didn't speak English, would not have known what was going on when the witnesses were testifying in English. And so having the mother there really didn't fulfill any of the functions that the right to a public trial.
Except perhaps giving some support to the defendant, which was what the judge seemed to feel was important.
Having her sitting there, some distance from her son, was the only thing that offered. Yes, sir.
So are you suggesting now that counties and courts should go to the expense of making sure that they can provide interpreters for the viewing audience so that the audience then can have a meaningful opportunity to be at a public trial?
So
that they can understand? Because I'm almost thinking that you're saying that with respect to the mother, because she didn't understand that she couldn't have been a meaningful participant in this public part of the trial.
I didn't mean to suggest that at all. What I'm saying is if the sole exception to this closure order was his mother, it offered virtually no support at all. It was not really an exception to the closure order at all because she couldn't understand, couldn't see what was going on. She couldn't gauge whether or not her son was receiving a fair trial or not, which is the very kind of thing that the public trial right is meant to enhance.
Does the public trial right then apply for the state too? Because half of these people purportedly were there on behalf of the victim, and half were there to support the defendant, but all family members, regardless of which side they were on, were excluded. Mm-hmm. So if your client would have been found not guilty, could the state then raise a structural error issue on their right to have a public presentation?
I don't know, because I believe that would have raised issues about double jeopardy, defendant being tried twice. But I think at the time when it happens, the state certainly can say, no, wait a minute, there's a statute here that permits people to be present. If they wanted their family members of their victim to be permitted in the courtroom, they could have said, you know, certainly they could say this statute permits the opening of the trial for all members of the public.
Counsel, suppose I accept for the moment of the argument that the constitutional right to a free trial has been implicated here.
Yes.
Okay? No one objected.
Yes.
The general rule, with lots of exceptions, is that if you don't object and you don't give the trial court an opportunity to think about it and review it, it is waived. That's the general rule. You are not willing to accept the general rule, and that the general rule is counsel can waive on behalf of the defendant, right?
That's
even constitutional issues sometimes.
That is a general rule. That's correct.
That's the general rule. So what special rule do you want in this case that's going to allow you to win? Because there was no objection here.
Yes.
So what rule do you want this court to write?
Okay. I think the resolution of this case has to allow for one thing. The right to raise this claim, despite the fact that no objection was made, without the requirement of showing prejudice. Now, we can get there in one of two ways. This court in State versus Anderson, in what in my mind is a very analogous type of situation, held that the failure to object at trial would not transform a direct claim into one that could only be raised as a ineffective assistance of counsel claim. As you will remember, there the trial court had some contact with the jury, answered juror questions during deliberations without the presence of the defendant or his attorney. After all the dust had settled and the jury and the questions had been answered, the trial court summarized what had occurred to the parties and, in fact, invited a record from the defense and said, do you have anything to add to this? You want to make a record? Nothing was said. As a result, the state in that case argued on appeal, they waived their right to complain about this error. Even though it was a constitutional claim, they have waived their right to complain here because they didn't object. The important constitutional right there being the right to be present at all proceedings and the right to have assistance of counsel there. This court, in speaking about the importance of the right involved, ruled that the simple failure to object with nothing more would not transform this case into one that could only be litigated as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And it was the importance of the right involved there that I think drove the decision of the court. I would argue we've got a more important right here than the one that was present there.
Well, what I hear you saying is that the right to a public trial is a constitutional right, and that the violation of that right constitutes a structural error. That when you have a structural error, that error is prejudicial by itself, and that you don't need to object. Structural error, case is gone. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that, and I'm pointing to cases like State versus Owens or United States versus Owens and other cases that have said just that. You know, we've got a very, in my mind, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, if that's what you're saying, let's say it. Okay. Straight up. That's what you want.
That's exactly what
I'm saying.
It doesn't
matter about an objection. Structural error, this trial was gone. That is, it's violative of the Constitution. It's a do-over, right?
Yes. And let me explain for two reasons why I think that's the only logical way to approach that issue.
I'm going to give you other logical ways. Go ahead.
Okay. Think about why courts in the past, and this is unanimously held by other courts, think about why they have said we are not going to apply the harmless error rule when we have a denial of a public trial right. When the error is litigated as a direct claim, courts have said you do not have to prove prejudice. Think about why that is. Because the courts have assumed, given the importance of the right, that the failure to provide a public trial infects the entire trial process. It is a structural error and makes a fair trial impossible. Now, that's what you have courts saying when they're dispensing with the harmless error rule, and they do that for a reason. They say they do it for a reason, because a defendant could never prove prejudice in that case. Now, if that is the law, when we have a direct claim of the denial of the right, are we able to say that the closure wasn't infecting the fairness of a trial simply because counsel didn't object? The prejudice is still there. Under the state's argument and under the Court of Appeals position, you'd have a situation where you were telling a defendant, we know you were prejudiced by this closure. We know that. We also know that you can't prove it. That's what we have always said. Prove it anyways.
Well, another way of saying that is even if you went under ineffective assistance of counsel, counsel didn't object, should have objected if the right's implicated, and prejudice is assumed, is presumed, yes, by this era of law. Well, why wouldn't you just say down the line that, waiver is only permissible if it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
That is the way that the Walton versus Bradley case went, and that was our position initially, saying the first position that the court should take is these things can't be waived unless there's proof in the record that it was knowing, voluntarily, and intelligently waived. The defendant knew of the right, he was advised of it, he said, fine, they can go, I don't object. Unless that's there, I don't think we get to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I was later simply fielding questions from the court saying, well, what happens if we get there?
Could I ask,
Justice Prosser,
what was the entire length of the trial?
The trial, I believe, lasted 10 or 11 days. Testimonial-wise, it was much shorter. It was, I think, 4 or 5 days. The family was excluded through the testimony of 12 witnesses. They were only present during the testimony of 2 full witnesses and a portion of the third.
So how many days were they out?
Deliberating?
No. How many days were the witnesses excluded?
I apologize. I don't have the exact date, Your Honor. It was at least days, 3 or 4 days. I will check that, and I will hopefully answer that question in rebuttal.
Well, all the spectators were there for about 5 days, weren't they?
Well, when the court said they were there for 5 days, they were talking about selection. They were certainly there during the selection of the jury. They were there during what turned out to be quite a lengthy period of jury out hearings on motions in limine and that sorts of things. And they're present during the first 2 witnesses in the state's case, excluded thereafter for the remainder 12 state and defense witnesses.
And of the 12 witnesses, how many of them spoke English?
All the police officers in the case spoke English. I think there were 4 police officers who testified in English. There were 2 other state witnesses, I believe, that testified in English during the time that those witnesses, the family was excluded from the courtroom. And I believe there may have been 1 or 2 witnesses who spoke English during the defense. Those numbers are in the brief, Your Honor, and again, I apologize, I don't have them in my head. I've been told by this light I need to sit down. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll get 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the court. We are speculating why Judge Kunmanch didn't exclude some of these disruptive people as opposed to all of them, why she didn't make a better record, why she didn't more thoroughly exercise discretion on the record. One thing is clear, Judge Kunmanch saw disruptive conduct in the court on more than one occasion. It was engaged in by several family members. There was a significant concern about the sequestration order because 9 family members actually testified at trial. There was a legitimate concern about those in the courtroom discussing the case with witnesses who were not in the courtroom. Be that as it may, regardless of what we now think of Judge Kunmanch's ruling, no one questioned it at the time of the trial. Defense counsel said nothing. And it is apparently now the defense position here that a defense attorney never need seek to protect his client's right to a public trial. because the defense attorney has the right to bank that objection so that if he loses, he can come back on appeal, or in this case at the post-conviction stage, and argue, oh, by the way, my right to a public trial was violated. That cannot be the law, and it is not the law. According to the United States Supreme Court, in Levine v. United States, a decision in 1961, the case started out as a grand jury proceeding and morphed into a contempt trial. It's very similar to the Oliver case upon which Mr. Kaiser relies. And in that situation, the defense attorney never objected when that case morphed into a trial. And then on appeal in the Supreme Court argued that his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial was violated. And in that case, the trial was completely closed to the entire public. And the court found that the objection was waived, or more correctly, forfeited by the lack of an objection. And I invite this court to review the Levine case, which to this day has been followed in virtually every circuit that I have found that have found that this right is forfeited. And now Mr. Kaiser relies on the Walton v. Briley decision in the Seventh Circuit. I think we need to be careful here. In Walton, the state, I think it was Indiana, argued that the defendant had waived his public trial objection, and the Seventh Circuit quite correctly said, no, a defendant doesn't waive a right unless he does so knowingly and intelligently. The state never argued, as we do here, that the right was forfeited. In the subsequent decision in United States v. Weyenberg, the Seventh Circuit held that a defendant's failure to object to a double jeopardy violation in a situation where the second trial never should have been held, arguably, was forfeiture of the objection.
What does forfeiture mean, rather than waiver? And I think that's a correct distinction, but why don't you tell us and remind us?
Well, it's the inaction, I guess. The basically a decision by inaction that an attorney that does not interpose an objection at the time when the objection should be interposed.
What's the difference between waiver and forfeiture?
Well, waiver is relinquishing a right, to knowingly relinquish a right, to say, I understand I have the right to a jury trial. I understand I have the right to an attorney, but I am willing to give that up. And those fundamental rights have to be knowingly and voluntarily given up.
And that's waiver to you?
That's my understanding, is that
okay.
a defendant, those fundamental rights that are personal to the defendant, that a defendant knowingly gives up. So in other words, if a defendant shows up in court without an attorney and there's no explanation as to why that happened, we require a colloquy with that defendant to explain to him the right that he has the right to an attorney and to ascertain whether he's willing to give that up. So it's a voluntary, willing choice by a defendant, as opposed to a situation here where a right is available, but through inaction, either by the defendant or by the attorney, it's forfeited.
Okay.
And there is, I think...
Is that what happened here? Inaction?
That is what I believe happened here.
It was not a knowing voluntary waiver.
Yeah, and I can see that in my brief, that Mr. Nadina did not knowingly and voluntarily get on the record and get on the stand and say, I give up my right to a public trial. He did not do that. What happened
here... Did the lawyer do that?
His lawyer, who represented him and who was present when these proceedings occurred before Judge Kunmunch, did not at that point say, Judge, I object. Your actions run the risk of violating my client's right under the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution to a public trial. And if you do this, Judge, there's a real risk that if my client's convicted, it will be automatically reversed. And I think you need to be aware of that. So, Judge, you better make a better record. You better exercise discretion thoroughly before you do this. You better follow the Waller v. Georgia factors. You better narrowly tailor your order. You better show a compelling reason, whatnot. None of that was invoked here. And in that fashion, there's forfeiture. And I find it interesting that Mr. Kaiser relies on the Stevens v. Manitowoc Circuit Court case where there was a complete closure of a preliminary hearing, and this court was very clear to state that is a violation of the public trial right, quote, if the defendant objects to the closure. And again, there was no objection here, and the same is true in the La Crosse Tribune case heavily relied on.
Can I just interrupt a minute? Is this a structural error? Is it an error for the court to close the courtroom to the public? Is that a structural error?
I'll answer your question carefully here. Is it a structural error to close the courtroom to the public? Yes. Close the courtroom entirely to the public, such as in the In re Oliver situation.
Okay. Now we're going to close it to the students on this side of the room or the family members. Is that a structural error?
And I would say that is not, because that does not implicate the concerns protected or the values protected by the public trial right. That is something altogether different. A structural error is one that affects the framework of the trial itself, so that such as a complete denial of counsel, complete closure of the courtroom where no one could observe what's going on. That affects the framework.
Two people observe, it's not structural?
I'm sorry?
If the courtroom is closed except to any random two people, is that structural? I want to know how much closing is structural and how much is open.
I think any time there's public access, you're not in the structural error mode. Now, you may be coming close. You may be in a situation where you're coming up on a due process violation. And I'm sure one thing that, you know, counsel may come back and say, hey, you know, the Levine case that I'm relying on was really a due process case. Well, that's true, although subsequent cases interpret it as a public trial case, and the language in that case is quite broad and applies to public trial. But, you know, when you're approaching the denial of a due process, that gets back into the structural. You know, we have the structural error is one that affects the framework of the trial. A non-structural error is one that affects the trial process. And that's really what we have here. Who can attend?
Please finish, I'm sorry.
Yeah, who can attend? And if the public is allowed to attend, if we have the press here, if we have two or three people instead of five or six or ten or whatever, I say that that's not in the nature of a structural error. That's more in the nature of a procedural error. It may be a violation of 757.14. It may be an erroneous exercise of discretion. It may be an unwarranted expansive use of the court's inherent authority to control its court under 906.11, but it is not a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial.
I hear from you a couple of arguments. I hear one argument that the facts here don't implicate the right to a public trial, a violation of the right to a public trial. I hear that argument. I also hear the argument that there is forfeiture, which assumes then that there is a right, but the right's been forfeited. Which of the two is your better argument?
Well, I'm assuming that if there's a public trial violation here, then that challenge is forfeited by the failure to object.
Okay.
But I'm also making the alternative argument that there was no public trial violation at all.
With regard to forfeiture, and you've been rather compelling about, hey, this is forfeiture but not waiver. Yet I look at the Court of Appeals opinion specifically with regard to paragraph 12, also paragraph 11, and their analysis is waiver. Are they incorrect in that analysis?
I think the analysis is correct. I think the term is incorrect. I think it really is forfeiture, and I think that Seventh Circuit decision in Weyenberg that follows the Walton case gives you the guidance on that. And I think
they cite, I mean, they say the purpose for the waiver rule, I'm reading from paragraph 12, has often been stated, and then they cite waiver rule cases. So is it your position to the extent that they cite waiver rule cases and they rely on a waiver analysis that it is
in
need of repair? How's
well, I think that? Huebner, yeah, one of my cases that I cited heavily and the court relies on is the Huebner case, which is really more in the nature of a forfeiture. It's a failure to object case, which in my mind, and I think the law is pretty clear now, that really is more in the nature of a forfeiture rather than a, a waiver of.
So with regard to paragraphs 11 and 12 and maybe other places, I just focus on paragraph 12 because it was an area of concern to me, to the extent that the Court of Appeals in its published opinion talks about waiver in this regard, that should be clarified.
In effect, I would point out, in further on in paragraph 12, it expressly cites Levine for United States for the proposition, constitutional rights are waived or forfeited by a defendant or attorney's failure to object when the constitutional violation occurred.
Are you referring to their citation to the Kimmelman case?
No,
then?
No. They expressly cite Levine.
Paragraph 11. Okay.
Paragraph 12. 11. And they expressly cite Levine v. United States in a parenthetical referring to waiver or forfeiture. And they also cite the Fifth Circuit case that I heavily relied on, the United States v. Hitt decision, and the subsequent cases, which really are more in the nature of forfeiture rather than waiver. But
I don't disagree with you with regard to forfeiture versus waiver. My concern is that the language used in the opinion is waiver language.
Yeah, and I think that probably should be corrected.
And many opinions do use them interchangeably.
Yes, they use the term interchangeably. And that might have been what tripped up the state of Indiana in the Walton v. Briley case, that they said, oh, he waived it, and stopped there. And the court said, no, he didn't, because there was no voluntary and intelligent waiver of the right on the record. Indiana didn't follow that up with saying, well, no, this really is, we're really claiming that he forfeited the right by not objecting. And that's a different animal than a voluntary and intelligent relinquishment of a known constitutional right by a defendant.
One other area of inquiry is of concern to me, and that involves the Arizona versus Fulminante case, a 1991 case. And over the course of the years, I've had the occasion to look at that case many times. And this court has had the occasion to cite it with some frequency, too. And in Fulminante, the Supreme Court looked at what kind of errors are structural errors, and it included the right to public trial as a structural error. And then it said that those errors are not susceptible to a harmless error analysis. And that's what I've always understood the law to be. And we've discussed Fulminante many times in this court. Am I wrong in my interpretation?
No, you're not wrong. No, that's exactly what it says.
So a structural error is not, under Fulminante, is not given or susceptible to harmless error analysis.
That's correct.
A structural error
is not susceptible to harmless error analysis.
It's susceptible to forfeiture analysis?
I would argue, and there are several cases that find, I think, Carson v. Fletcher out of the Fifth Circuit, I think there are several cases that I've cited that have found a public trial violation and have followed Arizona v. Fulminante and held it to be structural error. But because there was a waiver, or better said, a forfeiture of the objection by no one objecting, it plugged into the Strickland analysis. And they clearly distinguished the situation of where there's a timely objection. They say, had there been a timely objection, we would have had to reverse. But
I don't understand that. That sounds like talking out of both sides of your mouth. Not your mouth, I mean, collective mouths. I don't mean to. I don't know how you talk out of both sides of collective mouths, but let's try it, okay? Anyway, this is my point before I get lost. To say that it is not susceptible, structural error is not susceptible to harmless error, are not subject to the harmless error analysis, as Fulminante said, and then, that's on one side of my mouth, and on the other side of the mouth, then talk about Strickland, which is the quintessential case on harmless error, I don't get it.
Well, because I think let's put it this way. If you didn't have that distinction, then no one would ever object to a public trial violation. There'd be no reason to. The reason why we require an objection is so that the trial judge can stop him or herself from making an erroneous decision. That if you object and say, judge, this is going to violate my right to a public trial, what, excluding a few family members? Yes. Why? Tell me why. okay, then I'll have to exercise my discretion. If you don't do that, then that's deficient performance in many cases. If you, in my mind, but on the other hand, if we don't make that distinction between an objection made and objection not made, then it's deficient performance if you do object.
Seems
because
to,
you don't bank that right for further review to attack a conviction.
Seems to me that if you agree that a public trial, lack of a public trial, is a structural error, then it seems to me you shouldn't be arguing forfeiture, because forfeiture is anything. You should argue, it seems to me that to be consistent, the argument should be that if you're going to weigh, if you're going to forgive the lack of a structural error, it should be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. So you're saying, hey, if
well,
this
but
is...
Well, but then someone's got to raise the objection.
Why?
How do you waive a right that no one invokes?
Plain error.
Well, but plain error only applies to evidentiary rulings, as this court has held in CEW.
Well, that's right, and it comes under evidence, but the cases are broader than that.
Right, and I
think isn't there any structural error that will cause a new trial, even though there's no objection?
Yes, the structural error, such as a complete closure of the trial, a complete denial of counsel without a waiver, those kinds of situations where you just can't tell, it's not possible to assess prejudice or harmless error because you've affected the framework of the proceedings. You've made a person go to trial without an attorney, and we don't know why the person went to trial without an attorney. You went to trial that was completely closed. But even in that situation, again, I point to the Levine case where the trial was completely closed, and yet the U.S. Supreme Court held that it was forfeited by a lack of an objection. And that's crucial here, because by applying forfeiture, you're forcing the defense to invoke the right and to not only get the trial judge to exercise discretion, but if the defendant is willing to allow the trial to proceed partially or completely closed, then you can have a waiver colloquy on the record with the defendant personally. But if you don't do any of those things, none of that happens. Is it fair to say that Judge Kunmunch knew that she was violating Nadina's right to a public trial by excluding a few disruptive spectators? Is it fair to say that by excluding half of these students, we're now denying a public trial to someone? Or are we just...
I think you get into the difficulty that you're having, because opposing counsel argued this was a denial of the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. You approached it differently, looked at it from ineffective assistance of counsel and forfeiture and so forth, but you didn't want us to decide whether this was a denial of a public right to a trial. And at least that was the argument you raised in your brief. And so my question to you is, you know, are you either accorded that right as a defendant through the process the trial court uses, or are you denied that right? It seems to me you're almost arguing you can be a little bit denied. And I'm not quite sure how
no,
that fits in.
You know, a lot of these cases talk about a triviality standard and that sort of thing. What it really boils down to is, was there a denial of a public trial or wasn't there?
I agree with you. Was there a denial here of a public trial right?
No, none at all. And I argued that, I thought, quite forcefully at
the
second argument
of
my brief.
It was the second part.
In arguing that there was no prejudice, there was neither deficient performance nor prejudice because there was no denial of a public trial here. So a public trial objection would have been improper, even if it had been made, because the public trial violation occurs when the exclusion of spectators or the partial closure of the courtroom or whatever we have infringes on the values protected by the public trial right, which are the treating the defendant fairly, reminding the prosecutor and the judge of their duties towards the defendant, of their responsibility toward the defendant and their duties towards the public, encouraging witnesses to come forward, and protecting against perjury.
Right, and I understand all that. So you have a different lens that we look at a claim to begin with, first to decide if there was a denial of a public right of trial, and then if we were looking at the arguments that you're making, it's really more a review of a discretionary determination of the trial court, whether the court appropriately considered the proper factors and applied the law to those factors. Is that
correct?
Where
and if it gets into a discretionary situation, then clearly the waiver of objection carries great significance, and the question of harmless error comes into play. And again, I guess the way I framed the argument was such that I guess I felt so strongly that the lack of the objection created all these problems. Frankly, we would not be here if counsel had objected.
But you see, if in fact you'd had, if you would agree that there were a denial of the public right of trial, and that's something we'll have to decide, but if you had started out agreeing with that, you'd never get to all of these other arguments because, as you've just said, a complete denial or a denial, I don't know if you can have a complete or a partial, a denial of the right to a public trial is structural error, right? So you wouldn't get to all these other arguments.
Well, I beg to differ because I think there is case law that I've cited that even in that situation, and again, Levine was a complete closure of the entire trial to all of the public, and even there the Supreme Court found forfeiture because there was no objection. And so there is case law that, subsequent case law, very recent case law from several federal circuits and state courts that hold to that view.
And read Levine again because it was my understanding the Supreme Court has also said that the denial of the right to a public trial is structural error, and if it's structural error, you aren't going to get to forfeiture either.
Mr. O'Brien, what do we do with the Waller criteria, the four factors that the U.S. Supreme Court sets forth in Waller? Quite obviously, the record doesn't reflect the circuit judge here taking those four factors one after the other and discussing them and applying them. What do we do with that?
See, I don't think those are even implicated here because, again, we're not dealing with a public trial violation. And
well, what if you're dealing with the implication of the public trial right as set forth in the Sixth Amendment? Don't we have to look at those Waller criteria? Waller is, if I remember right, about 24 or 25 years after Levine that you keep talking about. It seems to me Waller is very important in all of this.
But Waller, there was a specific objection at the time. And in fact, Waller, the court even remanded one of the defendant's cases for the state court or the district court to determine whether he had waived any objection under state law. And the Waller factors, if someone had asked Judge Kunmunch to apply them, I would hope that she would have.
Well, she didn't specifically. Are we free to go back and find out if those criteria are met?
I would say if you're willing to overlook the waiver, I would say that you are, based on this record, if you assume that the record is sufficient to be able to apply those factors, yes. But again, I mean, these are, you know, Judge Maroney in his decision discussed the Waller factors after they had been presented to him by counsel. Judge Kunmunch didn't have that luxury. She didn't know Waller v. Georgia even applied. And furthermore, with relation to Levine, Levine is still good law. Let's make no mistake about it. The cases continue to follow Levine. The Supreme Court did not expressly overrule it in Waller, and there's no indication that it was overruled.
Isn't Levine a situation involving a grand jury? And the fact that the court didn't then proceeded to trial and never reopened the courtroom after it had been closed for the grand jury
proceedings?
Correct.
It was a secret. It was very similar to the Oliver case. It was a secret grand jury proceeding that then morphed into what should have been a public trial on, I believe, contempt charges. And the Supreme Court was very clear that had there been an objection, this would have been preserved, but there was not. And, again, we're talking about a completely closed proceeding. So, you know, this gets back. Getting back to Judge Rogenczyk's question, it is important to assess what is the nature of the public trial right. And one of the problems I have with the cases in this area, they all read like law review articles and often don't get to the point. And I think we need to go back and read the old cases like Oliver and Levine to see what this right really is. And once you get further away from a complete closure of a trial, the less likely it is that you actually have a public trial violation because the values protected by it are not threatened. That if you have a courtroom that's filled with some of the public but not all of the public, if you have some family members there but not all family members there, if you have a court reporter, if you have court personnel present, the chances are that those values are going to be protected, even though the judge might have erred or erroneously exercised discretion, say under 757.14, by excluding members of the public who should have been allowed to attend.
Mr. O'Brien, I'd like to follow up a little bit on Justice Crooks's question and in regard to Waller. As I've already discussed with Mr. Kaiser during his first portion of oral argument, there are two major distinctions between the facts in the present case and in Waller. You've alluded to both of them so far. The fact that there is a specific objection from defense counsel in Waller, and the fact that Waller involved exclusion of the public completely. True?
Yes.
Okay. And in response...
Exclusion completely from a suppression hearing, yes.
Okay. And in response to Justice Crooks's question about what do we do with the four factors, the four-part test in Waller, you responded that you didn't think it applied because this was not a denial of a public trial. Right to public trial case.
Correct.
Which of the two differences, or both, do you believe makes it so, makes it that in Waller it was, and in our case, in this case, it was not?
In Waller, there was a complete closure of the proceeding to the public.
But in response to Justice Crooks's question, you pointed to the lack of the specific objection. And I'm just trying to clarify if it's
okay,
both, one
and
or
that,
both.
And that's a good... That's a good point. I don't think it's necessarily an either or, and I think that's where, you know, again, the point I'm making that, you know, and I'm relying on Levine, that, but also Waller in a sense, because Waller was complete closure as well, that even when you have a complete closure, you need to specifically object. And this court in the Manitowoc, Stevens v. Manitowoc, where there was a complete closure of a preliminary hearing, said if the defendant objects to closure, then you know, he's entitled to relief. And you can have a public trial violation if there's a complete closure. You probably do, depending on the situation, but I'll assume that you
and,
do.
And that relates back
But
to
that still has to be objected to, I would argue, and
right.
If it's not, then you
and
get
And that
into,
relates back, to, I think, to your response to Chief Justice Abramson's question in regard to what if all members, all the public but two were excluded from this room. And I think that's what I hear you saying in regard to the distinction between this case and Waller.
Right. And, you know, I guess you do analyze the core values to be protected, but if those values aren't threatened by what the court did, that if those two members of the public are present and can protect those values, then I don't see why that gets you into the Sixth Amendment. Again, it might be an abuse of discretion or
so
whatnot.
So then it seems your position that it becomes a very fact-dependent inquiry. Who are the two people left in the room, for instance? Does that become relevant?
That could be an issue. I mean, I think you do have to you have to determine, is the Sixth Amendment right implicated? How is that determined? You look at the core values. And what was, and not only what those people, who was left, what they had to offer, but who was excluded, what they had to offer. And I would say the further you get away from complete closure, the less likely it is that you're even implicating the Sixth Amendment. You're implicating other rights, maybe the right to due process, but you're not implicating the right to a public trial because, after all, the trial is still public.
But
not everyone's there, but it's still public.
But in all cases of exclusion, you would still require, your argument would be, we'd still have to look for a specific objection from trial counsel in order to go to the four-factor test from Waller.
That's correct.
All right.
Mr. O'Brien, see if I yet can summarize the state's position. In this case, there is no implication that the right of public trial was denied. Correct?
That's correct.
Number one. If the court disagrees with the state and that the public trial is implicated, it was the right was forfeited.
Correct.
Correct? Okay. Three, if the court disagrees with you about forfeiting, there still is no need to go back to remand this for a Mockner hearing on ineffective assistance of counsel, because the defendant can show no prejudice.
if the court agrees that there was no forfeiture?
If the court says
and so we don't get
there's
into
no
Strickland,
forfeiture, yeah. Then we don't have to send it back for a Mockner hearing because the trial court on post-conviction remedy did not have a Mockner hearing.
Right.
We don't have to send it back, you say, because there's no showing of prejudice, right? I mean, that's what I read your brief to say.
Well, no, not that there's no showing of prejudice. See, my argument would
okay,
be if you disagree with us on forfeiture, well, I guess that's true. Then Strickland doesn't come into play at all. I mean, I guess that I would say if you agree with us on forfeiture,
then
we get into
the
Strickland analysis.
Right.
Correct.
We don't have a Strickland analysis.
Yeah.
But if we disagree with you on forfeiture, then we have to go to Strickland. Do we have to send it back to a Mockner hearing?
Or
if
you
says
could,
no.
Well, no, because I think the trial judge, I think that we. And I've argued that the record is sufficient to make that determination because
there was no prejudice.
Defense counsel, we assumed for the sake of the appeal that there was deficient performance based on defense counsel's affidavit that he did not invoke the public trial right because he didn't even know one existed.
Okay.
And assuming that's correct, then I think you can independently assess the question of prejudice, as did the Court of Appeals.
All right. And is there any prejudice?
No, he has failed to prove a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Kaiser.
Yes, Judge. I want to just touch on three points as quickly as I can. Versus Levine, first of all, Levine is not controlling here. Levine, as the State pointed out, dealt with the Fifth Amendment due process right to a public trial and not with the Sixth Amendment right. Cases thereafter have always pointed that out. Even cases the state relies on has said Levine is not controlling here because it does not deal with the Sixth Amendment right. It also predates all this case law that holds a violation of a public right is a structural error which infects the entire trial. Levine was decided before them. There's a dissent that we quote in our brief that says that judge believed that Levine would not even be decided the same way given the case law developments thereafter. The state is also wrong when it says that no closure occurred here because it wasn't complete. We need look no further than case law from this court. Manitowoc County, not a complete closure. Gorenstein kept a single reporter out of a portion of the voir dire that was conducted in chambers, and a Sixth Amendment issue, the court said, arose. La Crosse, the same. The press was kept out of a certain portion of the voir dire. That was the only exclusion, a partial exclusion, not a complete. And the court said, no, it implicates the Sixth Amendment right. So the state is defining this closure issue much too narrowly. Finally, an issue I did not get to address previously and that the state brought up again, and that plays a fairly large part in the Court of Appeals decision, this fear that we have to frame or create a rule that denies any sort of review and requires proving prejudice under a Strickland test if a defense lawyer hasn't objected, because if we don't, it's going to encourage all defense attorneys to not object and, quote, pocket the error for purposes of appeal. In fact, the state went so far as to say, look, if they object, they're committing ineffective assistance of counsel. That is not true. A defense attorney's job in this situation was to make make sure that his client understood he had a right to have his family present and a right to object and had a right to a public trial. That was where the attorney fell short here. He didn't fulfill his obligation by not objecting. The court has made it clear that the public trial right is for the benefit of the accused, not the benefit of the defense attorney. And he is not performing in a sufficient way if he keeps his client in the dark about his right to object. Finally, it's dangerous to fashion a rule, as the state is suggesting here, that we need to preclude an avenue for relief. Because if we again permit a cause to go forward here where there's been no objection, the defense attorney is going to take advantage of that. The danger there is, first of all, that's speculative and hypothetical. But more importantly, it sweeps within its grasp cases like this where you have a defendant who very much wanted his family in the courtroom, who hadn't been in the country long enough to know how the American system of justice works, had no idea he had a right to a public trial, had an attorney who didn't know he had a right to assert that right. And so through no fault of his own, the right was lost. If you fashion a rule that says, no, because we want to make sure defense attorneys aren't manipulating the system, you have to object or you get no relief, those kinds of cases get swept up as well. And that's not the worst case scenario. You could have a case where a defendant go so far as to ask his attorney when the closure order is issued, do I have a right to object? The attorney could say if he didn't know, no, you can't, and the right is lost under the state's proposed rule.
Mr. Kaiser, yes. If the court doesn't accept any of your arguments, and the court says either it's not, public trial's not implicated, or if it's implicated, it was forfeited, does it go back for a Mockner hearing? The state says no because you can't show prejudice here.
If you're saying, if the assumption is that we lose and yeah. that the trial was never closed, we do go back for a Mockner hearing on all the other issues that were raised in the post-conviction motion.
What were the other issues? They're set forth in the brief. There was at least one ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
For failing to object during the closing argument. There was also a slew of errors that we complained about, Judge, during the testimony of one of the witnesses. And this, of course, leads to another issue. None of those issues were addressed by the trial court because the state never raised the very issue it's arguing now before the post-conviction judge, never suggested we had to prove ineffective assistance of counsel, never uttered a word about waiver, and as a result, those issues weren't addressed, and 2 years later, we'll be back there again at a second Mockner hearing.
According to page 3 of the, that's your brief, there was a post-conviction motion, and you had errors relating to the testimony of a Mr. Demby, ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to move for a mistrial and object, and newly discovered evidence claim.
Yes, Judge.
And there was no evidentiary hearing, as I understand it.
On any of that, no.
Pardon me?
On any of that, no, Judge.
No. What there was argument before the court in brief, before the trial court in briefs. Is that right?
Correct. Only an argument on whether or not Judge Kumanich had improperly closed the hearing. Again, the state never raised this ineffective assistance of counsel claim right. at the post-conviction level.
Okay. And did the Court of Appeals send this back?
The no. Court of Appeals, I believe, Judge, indicated it would have to go back for resolution of those issues. Yes.
All right. Let's just look at that here. We reverse the post-conviction order, reinstate the judgment by the jury, and remand for any additional proceedings, and that's what you want. State objects to that.
I don't think we need to go back, Your Honor.
I know, but you,
well, if
you would prefer not to go back.
If we lose these arguments,
you may
we'll have to go back
okay,
for a second.
Okay, thank you.
Hearing.
The state takes the opposite position.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser, and thank you, Mr. O'Brien, for your arguments on this case relating to open public trial. We appreciate your arguments in your briefs in yet another variation of how to keep a trial open or closed. This concludes our hearing in this matter, 07AP5CR State versus Nadina. The court will recess for a few moments so that those who